Ready to proceed? Yes. And I understand all three of you will be arguing, correct? And you've got your time worked out with the clerk, and she's going to ding it for you and let you know it's time to tag team if somebody change, yeah? Okay. All right. You want to reserve some time for rebuttal?
Yes.
3 minutes? Very good. And you can proceed whenever you're ready.
Morning, Your Honors. My name is Scott Cardenas, and I represent the appellant in this matter, Kathleen June Jones.
Could you speak up just a little bit more?
Yes, sorry. What this case comes down to, Your Honors, is really a matter of fairness. It is simply not fair for the district court to force a protected person like June to pay an attorney rate for guardian ad litem services that she opposed and that under our statutes and court rules do not require an attorney. That is what this case is about. It's not about the model of representation and legal aid as the respondents and the amicus have tried to argue throughout the briefing. With that, Your Honors, before we get into the interpretation of the statute and court rules that we're talking about, I think it's important for us to first discuss the genesis of how Chapter 159 got to where it is today. For decades before 2017, predatory guardians and attorneys were depleting the estates of protected persons all across Nevada. And the legislature, after seeing those practices, decided that it would never allow that to happen again. And it provided strict requirements that any person must meet if they want to seek fees from the protected person's estate. The legislature intended for these safeguards to be there around the protected person's life savings, and that if anybody wants to breach those safeguards, they have to follow the law. And this isn't to point fingers at the parties in this case. This is just to provide the statutory backdrop for all of the statutes and court rules that we're talking about today. Now, as far as the district court's order, the first error of law was when it awarded the guardian ad litem fees at her attorney rate rather than at a lower fiduciary rate, as is required under our fee statute, NRS 159.344.
Well, counsel, did you guys oppose the original order appointing the guardian ad litem?
We objected at the hearing where the judge appointed the guardian ad litem on February 11th, and in the communication visitation petition where they first requested the guardian ad litem, there was an objection to the appointment of the guardian ad litem. And at that same hearing, June's counsel asked the court if it was the intent for the guardian ad litem to serve on a pro bono basis. And the district court judge stated that that was her intent. And then once we got the order appointing the guardian ad litem, there was no rate that was included in the order. So the presumption moving forward was that this was going to be an appointment where no compensation would be awarded. It wasn't until later, when we got the notice of intent from the guardian ad litem, that there would be a rate of $400 an hour being charged. Again, that was a notice of intent filed by the guardian ad litem. That wasn't an order from the court. And the guardian ad litem herself did not seek a correction or an amendment of the district court's order to include that rate, even though that's what the rule provides.
But you were on notice, though, because I believe Ms. Brickfield filed her notice of intent to seek fees on the same day she filed her notice of appearance. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. We were on notice, and June objected promptly to that notice right away before we even got to the petition stage. When the guardian ad litem filed her notice of intent, June filed an objection through counsel, saying that she would be objecting specifically to the rate that was being charged. She cited specifically to Rule 8. She provided her own information on what she believed was an appropriate rate. So June, all throughout the proceedings, was objecting about the rate. She was not being shy about her opposition to what the guardian ad litem was saying she was going to charge.
Didn't the order itself also reflect that the guardian was going to be allowed to request fees from the estate?
So the order itself included basically verbatim the language from the rule, and it did have the language about the guardian ad litem being able to seek fees, but it left out the portion of the rule that specifically states if the guardian ad litem is going to seek compensation, the rate shall be included in the order.
No, I agree with that. A moment ago when you were speaking about first learning about certain things and thinking originally that it was going to be pro bono, I thought that my recollection was that the written order that appointed her also said she was going to be allowed to seek fees. So at least at that moment, you would have known that fees potentially were going to be sought. I agree with you that there wasn't a rate in there. Yeah?
Yes, potentially. And as soon as we figured out what the rate would be, once the notice of intent was filed, that's when we promptly objected to that rate. So June was not shy about her objection to the rate throughout the proceedings before the district court. And this is important because when we look at Rule 8, It instructs us that when we're talking about compensation, we have to look to our fee statute, NRS 159.344, and that statute breaks down rates into four separate categories. It allows an attorney rate for, quote, services that require an attorney. It allows a paralegal rate for paralegal services, a fiduciary rate for fiduciary services, and no compensation for time spent performing secretarial or clerical services. The statute also provides that when we're talking about compensation, we have to look at the work that's performed regardless of who performs it. That's the language from the statute. So the focus here has to be on the nature of the work that's performed, not the title of the person who is performing the work. Further, Rule 8 is quite clear that a guardian ad litem cannot even engage in legal services. It provides that the guardian ad litem does not have the authority to waive the rights of the protected person. It provides that the guardian ad litem, their role is distinct from the role of the protected person's attorney in the case. And the statute also instructs us that the guardian ad litem cannot provide legal advice to the protected person. And it's also quite clear on the face of the rule that it also contemplates people who are not attorneys serving as a guardian ad litem. It mentions court-approved volunteers, and it mentions any other person the court deems appropriate. So the services, again, when we're focusing on the nature of the services that are being performed here, these are not services that are exclusive to attorneys. And that's important when we're talking about compensation and we're talking about a rate.
Well, would you dispute that Ms. Brickfield is uniquely qualified to handle these types of complex guardian ad litem cases? I mean, the court even acknowledged that was the basis for selecting her, is because she does have experience, and this case is quite involved, would you agree? And that, you know, even if you weren't using an attorney, you'd have to have somebody who is appropriately trained. Certainly, I don't think anyone disputes that Ms. Brickfield has that experience, would you?
Right, absolutely. And then none of our objections had to do with Ms. Brickfield's experience or qualifications. Our focus was on the nature of the work being performed. And I would just push back on what the district court was saying, that this required an attorney to serve as a guardian ad litem. Because we can look at other areas of law. Like here in Clark County, we have the CASA program, which provides guardian ad litem services to children who are going through the court process. And there's no requirement there that those guardian ad litems have to be an attorney. And those can be incredibly complex cases too, right? We're talking about termination of parental rights. We're talking about heavy constitutional issues. And there are non-attorney guardian ad litems in those cases that are providing reports to the court that serve as the basis for orders that might ultimately terminate parental rights or any of those other issues. Even beyond that, on this court's website, it has information about the Nevada Guardian Ad Litem Program, which provides similar services to the 6th and 7th Judicial District. And again, there's no requirement with that program that a person be an attorney to serve as a volunteer.
Were there any other volunteer guardian ad litems available at the time, and did you all suggest an alternative?
No, Your Honors, we did not, because it wasn't clear yet whether Ms. Brickfield was going to be serving on a pro bono basis. But it's also troubling that the district court itself concluded as a matter of law that it didn't even have the discretion to consider anybody else. Right? The district court in its order said that it either had to appoint a court-approved volunteer or an attorney, and since we don't have a court-approved volunteer program here, that its only option was to appoint an attorney. The district court didn't even consider the option that there might be any other person that it deemed appropriate, right? And that's what the rule instructs us. The district court in this order specifically stated that it was only focused on the language in the statute, and it did not.
And I apologize for interrupting, but let's assume that we agree with you, that that was an error by the court. What was the harm? I mean, it doesn't seem to be any challenge that Ms. Brickfield was qualified. Mm-hmm. Right. So even if the court should have recognized the third option of any other qualified person, doesn't really seem to be any harm to June, because a very qualified person was appointed to act as a guardian of life.
Well, I would say that maybe
harm, at least until the bill came and
right.
An objection to the bill.
Right. So there might not be harm as far as the appointment of who's going to be appointed. I think it would be important for this court to clarify moving forward that, you know, the district court erred as a matter of law, and it can consider other people, because we'll never get to that point if the district court concludes as a matter of law that it can't even do that. But I will say it's not harmless when we get back to the rate, when we talk about the compensation, because again, we have to focus on the nature of the work that's being performed here. And we can see examples, like I mentioned, with CASA and other programs, where there are guardian ad litems who are performing this work who are non-attorneys. Additionally, specific to guardianship, there's the SAFE program up in Douglas County where guardian ad litems serve in adult guardianship cases, and there's no requirement that they be an attorney to serve through that program. So these are just across the board, the kinds of services that are not exclusive to attorneys. And that's important when we look at the statutory framework that we're working within. Because again, the statute tells us that you only get an attorney rate for, quote, services that require an attorney. That is the language from the statute. And that is what Rule 8 directs us that we have to focus on when we're talking about compensation.
Well, but every guardian ad litem is going to be different. I mean, to your point, right? Maybe in a perfect world, in one case you have a volunteer through a court program, in another case maybe you have an attorney, in another case you have that any other person that's qualified. So the rates that each of those people might be entitled to is going to be widely divergent based on their experience and how they've handled cases and how complex a particular case is, true?
It potentially could be, but I think the problem here is that the district court didn't even do that analysis, right? It looked at the attorney rate that was being asked for, and it just outright accepted that rate. There was no analysis about, you know, was this within the market rate for guardian ad litem services? There was nothing presented to the district court about the usual and customary fee for guardian ad litem services. There was simply no factual basis for the district court's order that $400 an hour was in line with the market rate. Because again, it's troubling when we have, you know, other fiduciaries who come through the guardianship system and they also seek their fees, but they seek it at a much lower rate. We're talking anywhere from $100 to $200 with the public and private guardians, accounting services, bookkeepers, other fiduciaries that come through the court system. So for this one fiduciary to be at a rate that is so much higher than all of those other people who pass through the system and seek fees, I think that on its face is troubling. And that on its face shows that the district court here never did any analysis about these particular services and whether or not they were services that require an attorney. The district court just outright accepted the guardian ad litem's attorney rate, and even in its order describes the services provided by the guardian ad litem as, quote, legal services, right? And even on appeal, now the respondents in their briefing do not even try to make the argument that the $400 an hour rate is in line with the market rate. They basically just say outright that she should get $400 an hour. She should get her attorney rate. It doesn't matter what the market rate is. She's an attorney, so she gets her attorney rate. And that was essentially the same analysis that the district court went through, which, again, when we're looking at the statutory framework that we're working within, that is an error of law. You can only get that for services that require an attorney.
Would you agree, though, that let's take out the this is my attorney rate, so this is what I want to get paid. Would you agree that it would seem to be unwise to establish any kind of bright lines, either a floor or a ceiling, to say you got to get at least this much and you can never get more than that much? Because, like I said, every gal is different. Mm-hmm. Gal meaning guardian ad litem. Yeah. I'm not using it. And everybody has a different amount of experience handling the cases, and then every case is different. So the court has to have discretion in setting an appropriate rate for the appropriate person and the appropriate case. Yeah.
Yes, it does. And you know, we don't have an analysis from the district court showing what that would look like. It's just outright accepting the $400 award. But, you know, if we have the opportunity to build this record before the district court and there's actually some evidence that's presented, I think that that rate on its face is well above what it should be because, again, it's, you know, 3-4 times what other fiduciaries in the court system that we operate in are charging. And I see I'm in my rebuttal time if there's no other questions.
I'm going to add a minute to your rebuttal time, and we'll add a minute to whomever wants it on the respondent side. But we had a lot of questions, so I appreciate that.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Elizabeth Brickfield, the duly appointed guardian ad litem in this case. This is the first time I've argued before this court.
So. Well, welcome.
Thank you. I am, as I said, the GAL. I'm accompanied by my colleagues, John Michelson and Michelson Associates, and Dara Goldsmith of Goldsmith and Guyman on behalf of the probate and trust section. I know you saw my qualifications in there, but I want to point out a couple of things. I've been doing guardianship work for 25 years. I've represented families, individuals who have sought to get out from underneath the guardianship, minors. I've done them all over a 25-year period. I'm also a member of the Permanent Guardianship Commission appointed by this court. Right? And just to make it clear, I am also a 25-year volunteer for LAXIN, for June's Council. So And I've been honored by them in this past as their attorney of the month, as well as gotten an award that I had to accept in front of my named partner, then Sam Lionel, for having the most pro bono hours of any attorney at that point in time. I'm routinely on their honor roll, so pro bono service is not the issue here. Right. When I was appointed by Judge Marquis to do this, I was appointed and told pursuant to NRS 159.344, which is the statute for approval of attorney's fees, that I was to file my notice of intent, which I did. June's counsel objected to that. They objected to the rate, but they also, by the way, did not raise any objection to the fact that the rate was absent from the order. Nor, as Justice Lee pointed out, did they take any steps from stopping me from doing the work. I immediately began to do the work. And at the time that I was appointed, just to be clear, there were objections. There was a petition pending from two of June's daughters who wanted to see her, and objections to that petition by the guardian and joined by June through her counsel. I met with June in 2021, met with her twice, and I could see from my interactions with June that although she wanted to see her children and they wanted to see her, it was difficult and impossible for her, given her condition, to be able to facilitate the visitation. She had difficulties with the cell phone. She couldn't drive, obviously. Her dementia was advanced, and so she didn't have the ability to do that. Nor did she have the ability, because her interaction with her children was limited, to be able to say, I want to see you, or to say that to her grandchildren. So it was my boots on the ground, appointed by Judge Marquis, that did the report that was done in four pages that told the court and told the parties that they each wanted to see each other and they each wanted to be involved with each other, and they needed to be able to do that without the interference of the then guardian. Judge Marquis relied on that report in part when she did her evidentiary hearing and findings and removed that guardian and refused to impose a visitation schedule. And June's counsel had capitulated to June's desire to the visitation when they proposed a limited schedule and, in fact, withdrew their objection to it. This court upheld Judge Marquis's order in July of this year, in its entirety, including that reliance on my report.
Mr. Appel, can you just speak briefly to counsel's distinction between, it's not the person doing the work, it's the nature of the work that's being done. If you're doing attorney work, you should be paid at attorney rates. If you're doing fiduciary work, it's presumably a lower rate at a fiduciary rate. What do you say to that?
Well, so I think, first of all, the guidance that we have by statute for fiduciary rates is found in the probate section. And that is a statute that says a fiduciary gets a rate that's based on 4%, then 3%, then 2%. I'd apply that rate to June in this estate in this matter, my fees would have been double what I charged. If I applied the probate rate for an attorney representing a fiduciary in the matter, my fees would have been triple what they were. My fees were based on the hourly work, and the work that I was doing, although it may not necessarily be perceived as legal work, was done as a result of my 25 years of experience. It was my experience in talking to June and being able to hear what she had to say, being able to hear what the children would have to say, to understand the interference that was being run by the guardian and how that was contrary to the statute.
So how did you come up with the $400 rate? The hourly rate?
That it was my current attorney rate at the time. And it was, from other billings I've seen, not that far off or actually equivalent to what other fiduciaries charge. When I filed my petition for fees later in 2021, June's counsel again objected. But again, they objected for the same reasons they objected in the past. And again, they objected pursuant to NRS 159.344, which is the statute governing attorney's fees. And again, they did not raise the issue of the failure of Judge Marquis to put a rate in there. I went into this matter because I could see that there was a dysfunction in this family. So when Judge Marquis's office called and asked if I would do this, I could see there was a dysfunction. I read the pleadings. I read the papers. I attended a few hearings. I interviewed people. I produced a report that I did it as efficiently and cost effectively as it could be done. I did 15 hours of work in total in my office. 14 were mine. I doubt, I don't want to say I doubt, I know it's my experience and expertise with these cases that made it able to do it in such a small period of time for such a limited amount of money. And I do want to point out that after the appeal was filed, this case has not gone to settlement conference because June's counsel in the case appeal statement said there's no way to settle this case. So there's been, this is essentially a fee dispute, and there was no opportunity for me, for the Guardian, to be able to resolve it outside having to undertake this appeal. So if you have any questions, any more questions, I'm happy to answer.
Just one of the factors that we consider is whether or not you conferred an actual benefit.
I did.
Would you say that you did that?
I would say not only that I conferred an actual benefit, but Judge Marquis, in her order, pointed out that the benefit was that I had made this report available, that I had attempted to reach a settlement, and that the fact that the evidentiary hearing could not be avoided was not because of my best efforts. So it was a benefit. No one else prior to my report had told June that her children wanted to see her. And no one else prior to my report had told these children that their mother wanted and their grandmother wanted to interact with them. But it was this four-page written report in March of 2021 that told them that, right, and helped them to go forward to be able to communicate with their mother and grandmother. Right. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Brickfield.
Mr. Michelson.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Your Honors, I'm John Michelson on behalf of respondents Robin Friedman and Donna Simmons. How much time have I got before, if I want to leave Ms. Goldsmith, 4 minutes?
You got 7:52 right now, so that would be
about three minutes.
Okay. I'll try to move through this. I wanted to address a couple points that Legal Aid brought up. One was that they talk about that a guardian ad litem cannot be an attorney, and I believe counsel didn't finish that sentence for the protected person. It doesn't mean that it's clear that they're not an attorney for the protected person, but absolutely can provide attorney services for anyone else in the court. And NRS 159344 Part 10 specifically has a part there that says any attorney appointed by the court can use this enhanced review process to get your fees, get due process, have your fees approved. I also want to point out that I'm not sure under their arguments that any attorney can be appointed because they keep saying they can't represent. It's almost like their pleadings read that if you don't represent the protected person, then you're not an attorney anywhere. So does that mean we can never pay anyone at an attorney rate? And that's kind of where I'm getting from that. There was also a point brought up in their reply where they were saying that they never had a chance to review Judge Marquis's order where she made it the law of the case that June cannot direct her legal team. And that is not true. There's been a subsequent petition, and that's come out. We showed them the email that we sent to June's counsel saying, here's the order the judge asked us to prepare. Do you have any comments? The attorney responds and says, no, I have no comments on that, and didn't offer any alternate things. So I just want to say they had plenty of opportunity to do that.
And Ms. Michelson, do you think
yes.
that the court erred by holding essentially that because there were no volunteer JALs that an attorney had to be? She was compelled to appoint an attorney?
Thank you, Justice Lee. I do think that is the direct reading. It's unambiguous. I mean, that's what the statute, it's 159-0445 Part 3. It says, if then, it's a logical thing. If there's a program in the county, you may appoint a volunteer, which I looked it up in the dictionary, means for free. If not, then you go to an attorney. I think Judge Marquis is just saying, hey, this is what the statute says on its face.
There is a third option there. I'm not going to sit here and speculate as to what that person may be, the any other.
Yeah.
To me, it would probably be either an attorney or somebody that's trained through a court program. But potentially, I guess, you know, maybe somebody moves in from out of state that has guardianship experience but hasn't been through the court
yeah.
program and isn't an attorney. But how the court would know about them, I have no idea.
and no one else was proffered, but I would say I believe that's in the rule. I'm not sure that that's in the statute, but I may get corrected on that. We were involved in entrenched, it was like trench warfare. I mean, just to review for the court, there are approximately 640 pleadings in this case, nearly 40 contentious hearings, an all-day settlement conference, an evidentiary hearing, three appeals, and two writs to the Supreme Court, all brought by June's counsel. This has been witheringly expensive, and it was like trench warfare. At a certain point, we couldn't get visitation. We tried meet and confer for like 2 years because we kept being told we were forcing. We asked for a fresh perspective. And Your Honors, I want to submit to you that families in Nevada are desperate for this option, that at times when their loved one has severe mental illness, drug addictions, severe dementia, and of course they're saying things that just don't, in some cases, they don't make any sense. But if the only voice out there is only going to say that voice, we need best interest standard. It needs to be there.
Do you think that June was prejudiced by not having the fees initially set forth in the original order appointing the GAL?
I don't. It was four business days later, and they objected. And so we submit that that's harmless error. The last thing I'd just say very briefly is that
I'm going to give your side an extra minute and Mr. Cardenas an extra minute as well. We've had a lot of questions today, so go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. In this case, there was, we're saying this is an unusual case, 100% of the medical evidence, all of it, not the majority of it, it all said she lacks capacity to direct her legal affairs, any of her affairs. And then on top of that, the court finally had to make a specific finding of that, and it was the law of the case before their briefs were filed. We submit, Your Honor, that under rules of professional conduct, they like to cite to professional conduct rule 1.14 to say we're commanded to continue an attorney-client relationship. But they leave off the next part. Where reasonable. At a certain point, you have to be candid with the court and say, I have to submit, either I have to get another opinion or I have to submit to all the evidence and the law of the case. She can't direct me. And so that's why we're asking for sanctions in this case. It's been so expensive on the parties. And we also submit that most of their pleadings are harmless error. They had notice. And I'll yield my time to Ms. Goldsmith.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. To address your question, Justice Herndon, one thing that could happen is I could foresee a case where you need a psychiatric guardian ad litem. And realistically, in the guardianship arena, the guardian ad litems who are appointed when you're dealing with the skill set of Ms. Brookfield or many of us who are members of the probate and trust section, we're realistically special masters under Rule 53. Because we're coming in, we're providing a report, boots on the ground, for information that would not be available to the judge. In this case, there was difficulty with the protected person coming to court. There was difficulty having what really she wanted. You needed somebody who was able to elicit that information in a proper manner, understanding. And as an attorney in the office of the court, we understand that. Ms. Brookfield was able to take that information, provide it to all the parties, and hopefully resolve the case, because that's oftentimes what's the result of the attorney guardian ad litem who are appointed. And realistically, a guardian ad litem, and I do believe that there was error by Judge Marquis with regard to why she found that she could only appoint an attorney. I would submit she could appoint a psychiatrist if she had issues, whether somebody was really had bipolar or had a disease or whether they were faking it. I mean, there's all kinds of issues that the court could have on a special expedited basis that she needs to have these tools in her toolbox. I think that if you are in a situation where you're limiting the tools in the toolbox, that's a problem. I think that the section, we agree that there were problems in guardianship, and these statutes were, and the rules were promulgated in order to prevent predatory guardianships. This is a family guardianship. This is mom and her kids. This is who's fighting in this case. The reality is that oftentimes the June's counsel, the law firm that June's counsel is employed by, they represent many of the protected persons in the Clark County. They don't represent all of them. Sometimes they have private counsel. When we sit as private counsel, if we can no longer have a meaningful relationship with our client, we have a duty under the rules, under the ethics rules of professional conduct, to come forward and tell the court, Your Honor, I have a situation where I used to have a relationship with my client where he or she could direct me. I have a long history with the client. I've represented them for 10 years, 20 years. May I continue in that fashion? And the court may then appoint a guardian ad litem. They may leave me or that person in place, or they may put both in place. But we have an ethical obligation to do that. And the connection between...
June had a separate counsel.
June has separate counsel, yes. June's counsel has separate counsel. But that counsel never advised the court that they could no longer have a meaningful relationship with her. There's evidence based upon Dr. Brown's report that that had occurred, but they never came forward to the court. And please keep in mind that Ms. Brickfield was really not a guardian ad litem for all things. And I would submit to you, if she was checking on whether she was getting dietary things given to her correctly, that wouldn't be appropriate for Ms. Brickfield to do. That's somebody who's at a lower rate. So I think you need to look at what's being done. June did not have a guardian ad litem for all things. She had a guardian ad litem to address specific issues that Judge Marquis needed direction on. Judge Marquis, I also would submit, because she conducted a Brunzell analysis in this case, as she must in every case where attorneys come into her courtroom, going through all those factors, had to look at the services provided, the skill, and the result. Went through all of the Brunzell factors, did that analysis. I would submit to you that because we have two judges in the guardianship arena who review all petitions for fees, that these judges in the 8th Judicial District Court have a very good knowledge of what is an acceptable fee for the services that are necessary in any given guardianship case.
So would you, and I understand the concerns that are raised in the amici brief, but it seems to me that the concern is less about what we call the person and more about whether they're eligible to get fees commensurate with what their position and experience and duties are in a particular case. Is that a fair statement?
Absolutely. There's often times where attorneys are willing to take cases pro bono, like Ms. Brickfield. I have a similar resume with my law firm as well, with awards and service. But that should be a decision that we make. Oftentimes when we're appointed in these cases, the judge needs an answer yesterday. They need this done. So it's not that we can massage them into our practice. It's something that we have to put on the front burner and get this, because everybody who's involved in a guardianship should have the best interests, and the needs of the protected person is really what's at issue. And I think that the objection to fees in these types of cases, or with this case should be about June. It shouldn't be about all cases. But from the amicus perspective, because we're here, we're not the ones who filed the appeal. We're merely asking to be able to respond. We think it's necessary to point out that analysis of what's reasonable should be made on an ongoing basis by counsel like June's counsel to determine whether it's in her best interest or whether she really wants to go forward with an appeal. Oftentimes people will have a situation where you have a legal right and they point out that they're enforcing the legal rights. Just because you have a right to do something doesn't make it right. If my neighbor steps on my grass, should I sue them for trespass? I didn't authorize it. That would be ridiculous. So you have to look at whether it's viable and whether you're going to have the resolution or the solution that you want. And I think that's important. We need to all be reasonable in these cases.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I say one sentence, or am I done?
No, I gotta let you guys stop at this point. Thank you, though. All right, Mr. Cardenas.
Thank you, Your Honors. Just a couple of points on rebuttal. First, I want to address this discussion about June's capacity. I want to point out that since the briefing was completed in this case, the district court actually addressed a motion from the guardian to have us removed from the case or to have the scope of our representation limited. And the district court considered the exact arguments they're making in the amicus brief. The district court ultimately denied the request, said it wouldn't remove us, said that it wasn't going to limit the scope of our representation, and it found that there wasn't sufficient evidence to show that there was any ethical violation, as they've alleged. And this is important because, you know, they're essentially asking to change the model of representation, to change the system of guardianship as we know it. And this debate was already settled back in 2017 when the legislature overhauled the statute. It had to have been keenly aware that when it was providing the right to counsel in guardianship cases where almost everybody is of diminished capacity or lacks capacity altogether, that their right to counsel, you know, shouldn't hinge on their capacity. That would affect every single case. So if the attorneys in this section want to lead the charge on this change, then they should do that before the legislature. They should seek it before the proper bodies and allow everybody to be a part of that conversation, all of the stakeholders in the guardianship process. Additionally, so in regards to the discussion about the fees, It's always the fee seeker's burden to show that they are entitled to fees, right? That's why I think it's important for us to understand the genesis of how we got the fee statute that we have today. The legislature made clear that if you want to get fees from the protected person's estate, you have to follow the law. And that's all that we're arguing. We're just saying, if you want to get paid, then you have to follow the law, you know, to the letter. And if you don't, we have an obligation to object and to protect the protected person's estate and their legal rights. That's an obligation that we have under the rules. And this comment that there was no settlement or no discussion, we reached out multiple times to the guardian ad litem once the fee petition was filed to ask for a reduction in fees. And we were told that there would be no reduction at all and that this would be left up to Judge Marquis. So we have tried to work with the guardian ad litem. We have pointed out our concerns and why we think that the rate isn't appropriate. But there was complete pushback when it came to that. Additionally, I also just want to touch on the discussion that was made about these services being primarily legal services, right? I think that the district court agreed with that analysis, that it was legal services, which was error, right? The district court at all times, like the respondents have viewed these services as legal services when they're not. We can look at the plain language of the rule. We can look at our statute and we can see that there are, any number of people that can serve in this guardian ad litem capacity that aren't attorneys. So this cannot be the kind of role that is exclusive to attorneys and that is considered exclusively legal services. And I think it's interesting today, Your Honors, that really this court has seen a snapshot of what the guardianship process is like a lot of times. It's not uncommon for us to be the lone voice in the courtroom that's fighting for the protected person and simply asking people to follow the law if they want to take our client's autonomy, if they want to take money from our client's estate. All that we're asking is that the law be followed. And
would you agree that the standard of review here, I know it's not attorney's fees, we're talking about a guardian ad litem, but we're just dealing with an abuse of discretion standard. This isn't something that we're reviewing de novo.
Well, I would say it's de novo as to the errors of law that the district court committed. Like we've talked about finding that, there's not that any other person that could serve, but also just outright awarding the guardian ad litem her attorney rate rather than a lower fiduciary rate, right? I think that was an error of law because the fee statute instructs us that you only get an attorney rate for attorney services. And the district court didn't do that here, just accepted the attorney rate outright without any analysis. And unless there's any other questions, Your Honor, I'm done.
Thank you.